So thank you very much for the invitation. It's wonderful to be here.
Yes, I'm feeling quite head full, and I'm hoping that I'm not going to overload you with more information. In fact, what I'm aiming to give you is more just a flavour of the kinds of research that we do in the 21st century when we're looking at parents and how they influence children. But I will be focusing on that transition to parenthood, because that's something that is very much topical for the research I'm doing at the moment. Before we start, if you've got a pen and paper, could you just spend a moment doing this? Otherwise, just do it in your head. It doesn't matter. It will become clear to you why later. This is by way of kind of role playing. This is one of the things we ask our parents to do, or even our parents to be to do, is to imagine their child, or to think about the child that they do have, what kind of a child that person is, and how the two of them get along. And based on all that, we then look to see how that relates to how they're actually interacting with their children. So how people talk about their children, how they talk to their children, what are the links? So if you've just got those ideas in your head, then at the end of the talk, we will come and you'll be able to diagnose yourselves a little bit, perhaps. Okay, so my roadmap for today is I'm going to give you a little bit of a kind of historical overview of research on parenting, on mothers and on fathers, and then, because one of the things that we've really come to understand is actually so much of this is driven by the children rather than the parents. It's not a one-way thing. So understanding children and their development makes a difference. And so that's where most of my research comes in. I'm a developmental scientist. I'm particularly interested in two key areas of children's social cognitive development: their ability to understand other people as agents with thoughts, feelings, intentions, and how that guides their behavior, but also their own ability to regulate, to stop and think and not do that impulsive mad thing that can get us into trouble. And so my interest in parents is how parents help children acquire these two skills in particular. And so I will finish with some hot off the press findings from a current study that I'm running at the moment. These children are only just hitting 14 months or so too young for them to be doing any of that sort of thing, but we're hoping to get some of the very early predictors of these outcomes. About 10 years ago, I set this as an exam question. I got into trouble for it because it turned out that actually quite a lot of Cambridge finalists don't know what the word pillory means. So I had to stand up and explain. So I have learnt to be really much more mainstream in my language. I think it ought to be self-explanatory that if you're moving from pedestal to pillory, then pillory is probably the opposite of pedestal. But this notion of thinking about mothers as being both good and bad at the same time goes all the way back. So we have Jung in 59 talking about both the loving mother, the source of nourishment and support, but also the terrible mother. There's always that fear of abandonment, if you like. And here's Katharine Hepburn saying, I would have been a terrible mother because I'm basically a very selfish human being. Not that stopped most people going off and having children. So you do get both sides to it. So thinking about motherhood in this kind of very black and white way, that's something that has characterized a lot of psychological research. So most famously, I mean, for me, I did my PhD on autism and was really shocked to discover that for quite a long time, people did think that somehow autism might be caused by refrigerator parenting. So not only were these women struggling with having children with difficulties that were undiagnosed and hard to understand, but then they were also being blamed for this as well. So this notion that in some ways being cold and unresponsive to your child could produce autism, we know that's no longer true. But at the same time, people were also describing other mothers as being schizophrenogenic. So schizophrenia was also attributed to mothers placing their children in a kind of double bind, where you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, and it's all the mom's fault because she's saying one thing and she means another. So there is a background of research on motherhood which really does make them very culpable for all sorts of things. And we've come a long way from that perspective within research, but actually in society, we haven't changed that much. So if you think just about this year, the debate there's been where, you know, if you're a mum, that it's a problem if you go to work, it's a problem if you don't go to work, it's a problem if you're a yummy mummy because then you're shallow, it's a problem if you're not a yummy mummy because then you're not trying hard enough, and if you're not a mummy at all, then you're really not qualified to do anything or say anything. I mean, that culture of blame is still very much there with us today. Just to kind of quickly whiz you through the sorts of ideas that we've had. So we've gone from motherhood just being about maternity and giving birth and support. Then in the 50s, this notion that you could also be a domestic goddess, that you were supposed to keep a clean house, and that was where a lot of the judgment would come in. Then in the 60s and 70s, this notion that it's not enough to be a mother, that you actually also have to have a career and to be fulfilling yourself, getting an education. People like J.K. Rowling have been amazing in transforming attitudes to single parents, but again, being a mother but without a dad, even if the dad is the one who's walked off, it's still the mum who's going to be taking a lot of the blame. And then most recently, this notion, the changes in attitudes to women who are having children with other women. So there's been a lot of progress, but you can see the kind of the narrative that's going on there. So in a nutshell, what have we learned so far? Well, there's no support for the notion of mothers as all-powerful influences that can determine serious outcomes such as autism or schizophrenia. And there's really not that much support for the notion that infants need continuous care from a single caregiver. Multiple attachments are possible and may even be healthy. So there is still a view that mothers should be there 24/7 for their child, but it's somehow okay for the dad to come and go. And people will think about that father as having a very strong relationship with their child in a way that if a mother does it, that's kind of open to question. So we are becoming more acceptant of mothers in non-traditional contexts, but we still have some way to go. Thinking about fathers, so this is a quote from the Bible: train a child up in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. That for a very long time was the view of what the father's role was. You were there as a moral guide for your child, and that would have been partly why custody would always have been given to the father, because the father was the one who was morally capable of raising a child. Freud saying, I cannot think of any need in childhood as strong as the need for a father's protection. So fathers are seen as important intrinsically just by dint of being the father, not necessarily by doing anything much more. Come the Great Depression, the emphasis focused on the father's ability to be a breadwinner, to be a good father was to be a provider, was to keep food on the table, rather than to be anything to do with the children themselves. Then in the 50s and 60s came this idea that, well, maybe it was more the 40s and 50s, the notion that fathers were directly important as role models, that masculinity depended on having this example of a father. And then come the feminist movement, came this idea that maybe we don't want little boys to be like their fathers. So people kind of moved on from that. And so then fathers were presented primarily their role, according to Bowlby, was in supporting the mother. So she's the primary caregiver, and what the father can do is make her feel valuable and special and help her as a kind of as an assistant, maybe bring the odd breakfast in bed if you're lucky. And subsequently, since the kind of 90s or so, the emphasis has been much more thinking about fathers in pretty much the same ways we think about mothers, thinking about fathers as nurturing beings who can really connect with their children at an emotional level and possibly even change a nappy or two. Although, as I've seen from my study family, that still doesn't happen that much. So thinking about fathers, there is this shift across time in how people have conceptualized their role within the family. And perhaps what's lacking now is a sense of putting it all together, that perhaps in thinking and focusing very much on fathers as carers and caregivers, we're forgetting all the important things that they're doing as providers and as supports for the mother. So I'm reminded here of the parable of the six wise blind men and the elephant, where if you only get what you're looking for. So if you only find, you're only investigating a partial bit of that relationship or that role, then you'll only find that. And so you'll each come away with a kind of something that is accurate, but not the whole picture by any means. And perhaps that's what we need to be doing today, is to be thinking in a much more multifaceted way about parents, both mothers and fathers, thinking about how they create a harmonious home, as well as how they interact with the children directly. I said I'd say something about children as well, and the kind of developmental science. So this is a slide. So we've gone from an exam question to an admissions interview question. I have used this image before. It has famously been used a lot by policymakers. So on the left, you have a normal three-year-old brain, and on the right, you have a brain of a child who's been exposed to extreme neglect. They say a picture is worth 1,000 words. This is a picture that does seem to be very powerful in kind of communicating just how important good parenting is for child outcomes. When I'm interviewing potential candidates, well, candidates for potential places at Newnham or at other colleges, I get them to actually think a little bit more critically about these images. What we don't know is anything about normative individual differences. So we don't know whether, you know, that typical, what's normal could be very much bigger or very much smaller. They're being presented as if they come in two flavours, normal and neglected. It's really not. There will be an overlap between those. I also get them to think about whether it necessarily follows that the brain on the on that side, the smaller brain, means that the child has a lower IQ at home. And if they say yes, of course, then I get them to remember that, that women typically have smaller brains than men, but we don't think women have a lower IQ, so getting them to think through all of these things. So policymakers can use images like this in a way that's really powerful and shocking, but they may be jumping to all kinds of conclusions. So be careful of all the stories there. But it certainly is the case that there is an increasing recognition that whereas people used to talk about bad genes and blood will out and something deterministic about genes, we now have a kind of a sense that perhaps the determinism is coming more from this, these toxic environments. It can be very, very hard to flourish if you're in a very toxic environment. Having said that, the other kind of contemporary idea that has come out of research using longitudinal designs of the sort that Susan described is this notion of resilience. So a botanical metaphor that is used in the literature is a contrast between children as orchids or dandelions. And this comes from a Swedish word, a dandelion child. It's not meant pejoratively at all. It means a sturdy child. It means a child that will thrive no matter what kind of adversity they're growing up in. And most children are dandelions. About 70% of children show pretty impressive levels of resilience. The idea of using orchid was to get away from the previous concept of children as vulnerable, because the same children who might genetically be more susceptible to maltreatment or to negative environments are also the children who will bloom, especially when they're given positive environments. So it's not the case that they're more vulnerable, they're just more malleable, more susceptible, more plastic, if you like, in their development. And so this is a slide from New Scientist. So if you've got parenting going from the worst to the best, most children are following this green line here. It looks like it's going slightly down. That's not significant. Basically, the children are almost indifferent to the quality of parenting that they're getting at home. And that's fitting with this idea of good enough parenting. Once you get above a certain level of adequate parenting, then moving on into the domain of helicopter parenting isn't necessarily going to predict more positive outcomes. But you do get children who, for genetic reasons, will show are much more likely to flourish if they're getting very sensitive and supportive parenting. So this is getting away from the old diathesis stress model to thinking about it. They talk about differential susceptibility, but I think that orchid and dandelion is an easier way of communicating that idea, even if there are all sorts of problems with it as a metaphor, not least of which being that it's botanically inaccurate, because I think orchids flourish quite well from being neglected. But there you go. Anyway. So we saw from Susan's work that in all kinds of different family structures, children could emerge as emotionally very well adjusted. What I've been doing in my work is more thinking about parental influences on children's cognitive development. So rather than how well this makes children adjusted emotionally, does it help in acquiring key cognitive milestones to have supportive parents? And within the domain of cognition, I focused on, as I said, theory of mind and executive function. That's mind reading, if you like, and self-control, if you want to kind of lay terms to say the same thing. Language is another area in which we know that parenting matters, but that would be a whole other story. Now, to explain a little bit about what I mean by these terms, it's probably easiest if I just give you an example of some of the tasks. So we do these tasks with preschoolers, and we tell them little stories. So this is Andy, and this is Sally. And Andy has a teddy bear, which he puts in a basket, and he covers it up. And Sally comes, and she plays with the teddy bear, and then she puts it in the box and covers it up. And now Andy comes back, and he wants his teddy. Where will he look? Now, if you ask a three-year-old, they're likely to point to the box because they know that's where it really is. And they cannot get over the idea that if they know something, somebody else doesn't. Whereas a four-year-old will point to the basket and laugh and understand that that character, Silly Andy, has a mistaken belief that I know something that he doesn't know. So it's that's a litmus test for having a theory of mind, is understanding that other people can be mistaken. And that's what's at the heart when parents start to see that their children are starting to tell lies, that they can joke a bit, that they get a joke. All of this sort of thing depends on this cognitive milestone. So if they get it wrong, you then can show them that actually they're looking in the basket, and why are they looking in the basket? So you're giving them another chance to explain and to refer to Andy's beliefs. Now, if you look at how children do on this kind of task, what you see is, as you might expect, there's quite a steep improvement with age. So somewhere between 3 and 5, most children get it. Some children get it before 3, typically children who've got siblings who maybe do a lot of teasing and deception, and they pick it up that way. There are also some differences across countries. And what we're starting to show in my team in particular, but others in other parts of the world, is that learning to mind read is a bit like learning to read print. So it's learning to read minds is accelerated by exposure to support. So families where they're doing a lot of talking about thoughts and feelings, these children understandably are doing better. And that may be partly where children with siblings have an advantage, because then the sibs fall out, they have an argument, you have to explain these different points of view. You thought this, but he thought that, and it all becomes much more clear to them. We know that there are social influences on this above than just biological maturation from a range of studies. So I mentioned from that graph, you could see that there are cultural differences. So interestingly, although children from the East tend to be ahead of children from the West in all sorts of cognitive milestones, most famously kind of maths and things like that, in terms of mind reading, they're about 2 years behind. And there are all sorts of interesting ideas about why that might be that we could talk about. Deaf children, 90% of deaf children are born to hearing parents, and they are as delayed as children with autism on these mind reading tasks, whereas deaf children born to deaf parents show no problems at all. So that's telling you that something about the conversational environment, not having a fluent signer in the household, means that you don't have access to these conversations about thoughts and feelings, things that you can't actually physically see, things that are kind of absent that we have to infer. 10 odd years ago, I did a twin study involving a few thousand pairs of twins and showed that this similarity between identical and fraternal twins was exactly the same. So it really didn't seem to be a genetic thing. It does seem to be to do with environmental factors that explains why some children get this better than others. Training studies, we've also been able to show that you can actually make substantial improvements in the rate at which children understand these concepts, but by teaching them in preschool. And then you can also show it through longitudinal work, and that's kind of mostly what I've been doing in the book that Penny kindly mentioned. So in particular, I've been focusing on talk, and that comes from the deafness literature. It seemed that language and conversation would be an important thing to focus on. And we know that there are massive individual differences in the extent to which families talk to each other. So in this image here, this very blurry-eyed child, sometimes people want to have full conversations really early in the morning, and it's okay to kill these people. That is pretty much the attitude to conversation in some households that we have visited. In the book, I report findings from a study of 100 plus, well, we started with 140, but 105 that we followed for this period of time. At age 2, the frequency of conversational turns per hour range from 12 per hour to 802 per hour. So that's how much it varies. And looking at how often they refer to cognitive states, to thoughts, to memories, to beliefs, again, that range from 0 to 46, increasing 18-fold by the age of 6. So mothers that we're filming here were much more likely to talk to their 6-year-olds than their 2-year-olds in this way. It makes sense. You're more sensitive to children's interests, and that they're displaying that kind of interest at that stage. But importantly, what we've been able to show is that how much at age 2 parents were talking to their children using words like know, think, remember, believe, predicted theory of mind skills at age 10, so 8 years later, and that's controlling for all sorts of child factors in between times. So it really has a very long reach. How you're talking to your toddler will make a difference to how much they're understanding about their social worlds 8 years later. To give you an example of the kinds of conversations, all of this was very painstakingly transcribed. This is an excerpt. So conversation begins with, is a bad start. She offers him cheesy beans for lunch, and it turns out that there are no cheesy beans. So I wanted cheesy beans, cheesy beans. You want cheesy beans? I want cheesy beans, want cheesy beans. Yeah, you want cheesy beans, I know you do. And the child's hitting her on the leg. No, George, right, don't hit me, George. Doesn't do any good, does it? Hey, George. Do you know where we're going this afternoon? Do you know where we're going? We're going on a riverboat. Did you know that? Riverboat, big riverboat, isn't it? Did I show it to you? It's got the same name as you. It's called Georgina. It's a Georgina, not a George. Where the cows are, you know, where the cows are in the river part up there. And then it's going to turn around and come back again. Bring us home. Well, back to where we were. We get on it because we're going to get on it near the swimming pool. You know where the swimming pool is? Yeah, well, we'll get on it there. And it takes us up the river towards the cows and back again. And the conversation goes on and on. And this child has all sorts of anxieties. At one point, they're worried that the ducks will eat you. I don't think so, George. They've never eaten you before, have they? They've only eaten the bread you've given them. And then he's scared of the river. Oh, little boys are scared of rivers. Well, that's a good thing, really, because if you fell into the river, it wouldn't be good, would it? But you won't fall in because you're careful and stay with mummy. You won't fall into the river. You hold mummy's hand when you tell you to, okay? And it just keeps going. What's more truly amazing about this conversation, and actually it's not an outlier, I genuinely picked one that was fairly representative, is that all of this conversation takes place. George is wearing a cat suit, and she's also loading the laundry while trying to find what there is in the cupboard and fielding distractions from an older child. So these are mums who are really sort of doing everything. And you can see that she was using her cognitive talk to make thoughts and beliefs visible. I think if you go back to the last bit, yes, she does a bit of cognitive behavioural therapy. So she refers to a holiday when they'd been on a very big boat when they went to France, and you loved it, and you looked at the seagulls, and you waved to the people, and you were very happy on that boat, George. So she's reminding him of a time when he had really enjoyed being on a boat to make him feel more positive about the future. So she's helping him build up an autobiographical sense of self, but also helping him not to feel so anxious about this trip. Most importantly, she's distracting him from the lack of cheesy beans. There's all kinds of things that are going on. So we know that this kind of talk is really, really predictive of positive outcomes. What we don't yet understand is the mechanisms, because it could be that the mums who are doing this is just a really good marker for all sorts of other wonderful things that they're doing, like tuning into their child's point of view, like highlighting other things to the child, engaging in elaborative discourse, explaining things. So it may not necessarily be that if you pepper your language with lots of references to know, think, remember, that you're going to achieve anything. It's really just the kinds of conversations that are rich in that sort of talk tend to be the ones that are most supportive for children's development. Okay, moving on to executive function. The way I usually explain this is it's a little bit like the brain's air traffic control system, that we are bombarded with stimuli and things to think about and things to see and feel, and all our senses are going. And what we have to do, there's a part of the brain at the front, the prefrontal cortex, which filters things out and decides what's important. What am I going to pay attention to? What am I going to let through? And what am I going to block out? And that's something that matures over time. And so that's what you can see little children behaving in a completely impulsive way. They grab something, they can't resist the impulse to kind of pull it apart or something. And as they get older, they learn to self-regulate. So again, giving you a few examples, this is what I call the happy sad task. So in this silly topsy-turvy game, if I say sad, I want you to point to the happy face. And if I say happy, you point to the sad face, and you get the children saying happy, you pointing to the happy face or the sad face, depending on which one you pointed to. And even if they can do it quite well at first, it becomes quite effortful and the errors creep in. And so you can measure children's ability to self-regulate through that sort of task. There's also shifting tasks. So here you might be playing the shape game. So in this game, when we're playing the shape game, you put the red rabbit with the blue rabbit because they're both rabbits. And when you're playing the colour game, you put the red rabbit with the red boat because they're both red. So having learnt one rule, they then have to shift to another rule. And so you're measuring children's ability to switch in how they're thinking and how they're behaving. And again, it's something that shows massive improvements from preschool up. How might parents help here? Well, one of the things we know is that alongside trait differences, so obviously there are age-related differences, but we know that some people are just better and less impulsive, better at these sorts of tasks and less impulsive than others. But we also know for all of us, we have good days and bad days. And a lot of that is to do with our own kind of well-being. So when you're under physical stress or mental stress, you just haven't got the headspace to be thinking clearly and to be planning and to be resisting that biscuit in the biscuit tin or whatever else it is. So we know that there are state effects as well as trait effects on performance in this domain. And so probably one of the key things for parents is just to get children into the right zone mentally and emotionally so that they can regulate. So if a child is really hungry or tired, then you can't expect them to be self-regulating in the way that they might be when they're kind of at their best. So again, there are several lines of evidence for social influences on executive function. I mentioned cross-cultural differences for theory of mind. They go in absolutely the opposite way for executive function. So Asian children typically do much better on tests of self-control and planning and working memory than Western children, which is really interesting because in both the East and the West, these two skills typically go together. If you're good on one, you're good on the other. But we're getting these cultural differences that go in different directions across there, which I find really interesting. Bilingual children, bilingualism is associated with doing better on this. It makes sense because you're constantly switching between one word for something and another word for something. So parents don't necessarily raise their children bilingual because they want them to be good at self-regulating. It's an unexpected benefit of that and something to bear in mind when you're doing that and it's effortful. And I say that as somebody who's failed to raise her own children bilingual because I'm half French and I didn't manage to do it. Hey ho. Being depressed yourself, we know that maternal depression is associated with reduced gains in this domain. And again, there may be all sorts of reasons why that is the case. And we'll talk about that later. Training studies, you can make massive differences. So we know it can just come from the environment. And then scaffolding studies where you actually look to see when parents sit down and deliberately try to help their children to plan and to think things through, how well they do that makes a big difference. I've got a little example here. So this is a mum who kindly agreed to let herself be filmed and the film be used. Oops. That's a 7-year-old brother who keeps saying, "I'm not coming out." Okay, so I don't know what you notice about that, but I've watched a lot of these, so I kind of tune in to all sorts of things. And there are lots of ways in which parents can scaffold their children's goal-directed behaviours. Some of it is just about emotional support, making them feel encouraged, praising them, reducing frustration, that kind of thing. Some of it is cognitive. It's reducing the size of the problem space. So if they don't know where to begin, then you might suggest that we begin with the edges or the corners or whatever, giving a smaller problem, a more manageable problem for them. But on top of those two arms, the cognitive and the emotional, there's also something that we refer to as contingent shifting. And that is being able to tune the level of support that you give according to how much that child needs it at that moment in time. So when the child is struggling, you provide a little bit more support. And as soon as they're starting to show a bit of mastery, then you roll back. I mean, I think one of the things that you could really see from that mother was that she wasn't hurrying him. She was letting him take it at his pace. He was controlling, but she was being very attentive. And if at any point he was looking to her for help, she was there to provide it. And that's actually, it takes quite a lot of executive skills as a parent to be able to offer all that. We get quite a lot of parents who just go straight in and really think that the goal is to do this puzzle as quickly as possible. And they can completely take over, and that can be discouraging for the children. So it's actually really quite difficult to be constantly modifying your own behaviour according to how much the child needs it. But what you find is that those parents like that mum who are able to do that, they have children who over developmental time, so from ages 3 to 5, make more gains in this area of self-control. So it is in the long term better to put in that effort and to fine tune the kind of support you're giving, because then your child will more rapidly be able to do that sort of thing for themselves. And this is really important because we know that this area of executive function is something that's becoming the key predictor of academic success. So beyond IQ, how well children can manage their own thoughts and organise their own behaviours seems to be something that is really predictive. So from the point of view of a developmental scientist like me, the question that we came to then was kind of what makes for a dream parent? So we've seen from Susan's talk that gender and sexual orientation are just not relevant, but other characteristics might matter. And so these might include things like being able to talk to children about thoughts and feelings, being able to tune into the child's own view of the world and their interests, letting the child take charge of goal-directed activities, and giving the children regular but manageable challenges while reining in your own kind of negative feelings or actions, so that you're creating the best kind of environment for a child in which to grow. And I'm referring here to this book that's come out this year by Alison Gopnik, The Gardener and the Carpenter, which I think is a kind of riposte to the Tiger Mum book that has had a lot of media attention. So the Tiger Mum thing is the idea that you can train your child, you can be a carpenter and mould your child into a particular shape or form, whereas the gardener approach is recognising that some children will thrive with this kind of environment and others will prefer something else. And really your goal is just to allow them to grow and to put them in the right places, but not, you can't force a flower to grow, it will grow. And your job is really just kind of the looking after of the garden more generally. So turning now to the new fathers and mothers study and some of the new parents that we have. So this is work that we started a year or so ago. It's an international study. There are 205 families in the UK, but there are also 130 families from New York and 130 families from the Netherlands, which is really interesting because these are very different cultures for becoming parents. And what we've been doing with the UK families, who've pretty much all been recruited from the Rosie Hospital in Addenbrookes Hospital, the Rosie Maternity Unit, we have tried to recruit from Hinchinbrook, but that was less successful. So they're mostly Rosie babies. We saw the couples, and importantly, it's a fathers and mothers study. So everything we've done with the mums, we've done with the dads as well. Seen them at home prenatally, and again, at 4 months, 14 months, and we will soon be beginning the two-year visits. And we do a range of things. So the kinds of questionnaires and interviews that Susan's been talking about. We're also interested in stress, so we're getting saliva samples from both mum and dad. So we know that fetal exposure to maternal stress is something that is a cause for concern for children's development. Nobody's looked at whether dad's stress levels prenatally might also be making a difference. At 14 months, we've been collecting saliva from the toddlers themselves. That's not easy to do, as you can imagine, but we do know that high cortisol levels, high levels of the stress hormone cortisol, is indicative of a stressful home and difficulties with parenting. Mostly what we've been doing though is filming both the mom and the dad playing with their child in a variety of settings. And so what the overall arching aim of the study is to look at how parental well-being, both prenatally and postnatally, might affect how able they are to interact with their children in a kind of sensitive and supportive way, and how that might explain differences in child outcomes. We're a long way yet from being able to give you the answers to those questions, but what I can give you is a little bit of a sense of what the parents themselves think about becoming parents. So this is a short video that I made at a garden party that we held for the study families. We then complemented it because with some kind of older parents, some more experienced parents, if you like, because when, for ethical reasons, we couldn't take any of the footage from our study and just show it to you. The NHS ethics won't allow us to do that. You have to have prospective consent for everything. So we had to recruit new families to talk about some of the issues about becoming parents. And one of the things that became obvious was that I was getting very different answers from parents like these who had just begun their parenting journey and parents who had more than one child and were further along at home. And so that's why I wanted to finish the video with, you'll see there's a little bit of filming that actually took place in Newnham a month or so ago. So this is in answer to the question asking them at the garden party to say something about their journey to parenthood.
Okay, so where did it start, I guess? So Natalie and I started thinking kind of more seriously about becoming parents probably about 3 or 4 years ago. So we're married and we proposed to one another and we'd arranged to do that. And we had what we called, so we had a proposal, we had a babozal as well. Right. So we kind of actually asked one another, would you like to become a parent? And we kind of, you know, had like a little ceremony around that between us. And then after that, we decided that was it, we wanted to become parents. How's the journey been? It's been, we talk about it a lot actually. I think we see it as extreme. So it's been like some of the best moments ever the last 2 years since he's been born. But also probably some of the most challenging as well, I would think. Yeah, so sort of highs and lows really. I wouldn't change it for the world, but being a parent is kind of tough. And I think people recognise that, and it's good to be honest. I think every moment when you realise that he's developing and he's changing and he's growing so quickly. So it's the first moments, you know, it's the crawling, it's the walking, it's the talking. He's of an age now where he's putting words together and stringing sentences together, and it's lovely to see that and realise he's got so much more within him that he understands he's not quite communicating yet. So, he, you know, from our perspective, it's just kind of, you know, keeping up with him really rather than keeping up with us, yeah.
He's the navigator rather than the passenger.
I think so, yeah, yeah.
I think my journey as a parent started after I gave birth, because I was a very naive pregnant mother, or before even I got pregnant, I kind of never expected the changes that actually occurred after she was born. Like, I would say things to Chris like, oh, when she's born, we'll just go out every, you know, once a week for date nights. Like, what was I going to do with her then? I never even considered that part of things.
June has a much younger brother, mm-hmm. and it kind of assumed that having a child would be the same as being an older sister.
Yes.
What's the age gap?
19 years.
Oh, okay.
Yes, so he's only 11 now. What a big mistake.
So in what way is being a parent different from being a big sister?
It's all the responsibility.
Yes. Without saying, Mum, here's your child.
We can't pass it on to anybody. There's the bit when we were in the maternity ward, just everything finished and she needed to change, put a nappy on. And both of us looked around at the midwife thinking, what, aren't you meant to be doing something now?
She's like, it's your responsibility, you need to do the nappies.
Oh yeah, okay. We've got to do all this kind of thing.
So it started even before getting pregnant, just planning on becoming pregnant and thinking of, am I ready to be a parent? Seeing other parents, they look so grown up and you don't feel old enough. So definitely, even with those thoughts, it started way before even being pregnant. I think it's just amazing how, with all the bad things, with all the mess, the screaming, your life that's changed, becoming a lot more restricted, thinking twice about going to places because it's too far to drive, will she be able to cope with the journey, all that, why would you still even want to be a parent still? But I'd say maybe as human, maybe just wanting a family and seeing your child grow, there's just something about it that it's almost addictive. You just
so it's interesting in thinking we wanted a child for a long time, but now Henry's almost 1 month. But I definitely feel like I'm at the very, very, very beginning. Very beginning. So even if I see parents with like 2 children, I'm like, wow, they're like professional parents.
Yeah, no, I was kind of thinking about how, yeah, parenting is not really a skill, like, you know, being a doctor or something. It's actually a relationship, and that's something I've had to learn as a father. So, you know, I think if you focus on the outcome for the kids, I want them to be something, I think you'll possibly end up in trouble. And that's been a journey for me, is to not focus on that so much, but just develop a strong relationship with my kids where whatever happens, at least they'll be grounded in some values that my wife have imparted with them.
So we've got 3 children now.
You have.
And as time's gone by, the number of relationships is going up like this. So to start off, when it's just the two of you, it's just the one relationship there, and the firstborn comes along, and then there are 3 relationships, because, you know, you've each got your separate relationship with your child. But then number 2 and number 3 come along, and they've got relationships between themselves. This sort of you know, balancing act between being a team, everyone together, rarely happens. But lovely when it does. But, you know, or, you know, balancing out you know, what most of the family would like to do, but there's always going to be like one dissenter. That's a situation that, you know, you've not necessarily been in before.
I did love having babies, but when I look back at that time now, I think probably it wasn't my favourite time. Probably it was the least favourite time, in fact, of my parenting journey. And that as they've got older, I've found them more and more enjoyable, more interesting. And I think having teenage kids now is just fantastic. I love their banter, I love their music, you know, even their arguing. I think it just has got better and better, and maybe I'll find having adult children even better than this.
My journey started off with a lot of problems because I was only 18 when I became pregnant, and in 3 years had three children, and then their father left. So it wasn't the easiest of journeys at that point. And so thankfully it has got one heck of a lot better since then. And in fact, I think where I am now, or where I have been for the last perhaps 10, 15 years has been the best point. And I think now I've got the best relationships I've ever had with my children, and I hope it lasts that way.
So I don't know if you can get that sense of a journey and the progression. One of the things I was struck by when I was asking this question about where does your journey begin was how vivid but really diverse the answers were. So I had expected, when we first saw that pregnancy stick and we could go and decorate the nursery at home, we got some like June who said, actually, it really only began the day my child was born, because I had no idea as a pregnant woman what it was like to be a mum. But then we also got plenty who, like the first dad, Nick, talks about this babozle that, you know, years before conception, I mean, that was 4 years before conception that they decided to begin that journey to becoming parents, and they could pin it down to a particular day, a moment in time, when that was when they decided to become parents. So really interesting how individual those journeys are, and then also just how it just continues to change over time. With Abby being amazing about her teenagers and that being the best part. One of the other questions that I asked during these interviews, because I partly we did this for the Centre for Family Research 50th anniversary, but we also did it because I'm going to be doing a similar talk next week as part of the Festival Ideas, and the theme of the Festival Ideas is movement, which is why I use the notion of journeys to parenthood. And so I also asked the parents, what would you pack for this journey?
Teamwork. Yeah, I think that feels like the key.
Oh, I'd say get ready to lose your freedom, your life, everything.
Take advantage of the time before.
Yes, absolutely.
I'd say take it in your stride, just relax. The second time around, I found it a lot more enjoyable because I think I'm more relaxed.
Maybe flexibility, being prepared for surprises, learning more about yourself through having a child. Like, I thought, I'm a pretty organized, structured person, and I thought, oh, with a baby, it'll be so, you know, a bit more challenging, but I'm kind of surprised to see myself comfortable with a mess. Like, even, like, his shirt right now has, like, stuff all over it, and I'm kind of like, I don't care, I'll be with other parents, like.
You know, I could say all the usual things. I wish I'd been more patient and less angry and a bit more sleep, you know, all those sorts of things. But if I was going to pack something again, it might be two things. I'm thinking about confidence in myself. Because one thing that kids do to you is, if you're not confident, they'll just open you up and you question yourself and you question everything. And so maybe that would be one thing I would pack again. But the other one would be this thing about empathy, where instead of trying to control the kid, and obviously you set ground rules and all that sort of stuff, but as the child grows older, the nature of the relationship has to change. And therefore, the other thing you need is empathy to understand what actually this child has a really good point. Goodness me, I didn't realize they've got a brain, they can think, they've got opinions, and that's often a bit of a surprise. You know, you're so used to treating them like, don't do that, don't touch that, stop that, and all the sort of risk assessment stuff, which obviously is always there, but kind of you need to moderate that. And I think sometimes parents are the same, just forget, and you end up in this sort of habit of talking to a kid in a certain way, and this process of adjustment means you need to empathize with the kid a bit more, try and see their point of view to a point. Course. And it's what you said before about being open to surprise.
Yeah, surprise, flexibility. I think don't take yourself too seriously. I think, you know, you'll learn from your children, won't you? They'll show you new things, teach you new things. And also their growing up isn't going to be quite the same as yours was 20, 25 years ago. So there's no point in just trying to continually simulate the childhood that you had because the world's not like that anymore.
So some words of wisdom there. Patience was the most common answer, but I did think it was really interesting, the range of things. And actually, for cinematic reasons, I was told I could only use the clips that had been done outside because it would have been visually confusing to have the footage that I'd done inside. But some of the families who came to the Centre for Family Research and talked in a lab that are not in this said some of the most moving things. And I remember in particular a couple of mothers who talked about packing forgiveness for themselves, being able to move on to the next day and not worry about whatever mistakes they'd made the previous day. I thought that they were really, really open in talking about that. And I think there needs to be more openness about that because parents do blame themselves a lot. Okay, so just the last few minutes, just to give you a flavour of some of the findings that are starting to come out of this study. This is just to say something about who they are. So quite typical of Cambridge parents. They're 32, 34 at the birth of their first child, so relatively old, but not for Cambridge. The mums are more educated than the dads. The dads are earning more than the mums. What's that about, eh? This is before the birth of their first child, so it's not about career breaks. Anyway, so the first thing that we've been able to do, observational data takes a very long time and we will be a year or so before we are able to talk about that. But we are able to look at some of the findings from the questionnaires because that's obviously much, much easier to get to the answers really quickly. So what we've been looking at is looking prenatally to postnatally about how parents' well-being changes, how the couple relationship changes and their general kind of life satisfaction. And again, remembering the elephant, we wanted to have lots of different measures and asking both the mums and the dads so that we get lots of different points of view so we can see the complete picture. And it turns out that it's really important that we did that because you don't get a clear story at all. So some things improve, interestingly, usually more for mothers. Some things stay unchanged but are consistently different between mums and dads. Some changes were only reported by mums or only by dads. And some changes go in the opposite directions for mums and dads. So it's a really complicated story, what's happening as these people are making that journey, becoming parents. So some of the things that get better, prenatally, very high levels of anxiety. The birth of your first child, the internet is full of scare stories about the birth and about, you know, different kinds of abnormalities that your child might have. They show dramatic reductions in anxiety by 4 months. More steeper curves for the mums than the dads, which is interesting. Going along with that, their confidence in themselves as parents improves. So prenatally, a lot of these people do not feel that they've got any relevant experience, perhaps in caring for siblings or anything else. I mean, June had that experience with her being 19 years older than her baby brother, but that didn't seem to help her in feeling ready or prepared as a parent. So 4 months in, they're both feeling more confident. Again, mums more so than dads. I suspect that's to do with the mums have actually spent more time being a parent in those 4 months. So one of the things that doesn't change, life satisfaction. Interestingly, didn't change from prenatal to postnatally, but was significantly higher in dads than mums. Has that got anything to do with the pay? Who knows? There's perceived social support also didn't change. So it's not the case that families flock around once there's a baby. That pretty much stays the same. Or those that do, maybe they're already being supportive while the mother is kind of pregnant. The next two slides are the ones that I found really fascinating. So if you ask mums and dads about couple conflict, mums will say things have got so much better, we're not arguing anymore. That's gone right down. Dads say no change. If you ask about couple satisfaction, mums say it's as good as it ever was. Dads say it's much worse. So the dads are biting their lips. They're clearly not answering back. And so mum feels that everything is fine, but they're feeling left out, or they're feeling, you know, that she's not paying me the attention that she was, or maybe they're just not getting sex anymore. I don't know. But again, you're clearly getting differences in their points of view. And tied to that, if you look at their well-being, depressive symptoms in this sample actually went down prenatally to postnatally for the mums. I suspect that some of the prenatal symptoms of depression are actually, again, to do with pregnancy. So having difficulty sleeping or problems with with eating or whatever could easily be to do with being heavily pregnant, and that's got a little bit better. The dads, you're seeing this increase, so that postnatally, this is important, the dads are as likely to be showing depressive symptoms as mums, and everybody is aware now of postnatal depression in mothers, but there's much less awareness that dads postnatally could be depressed too. And we know that that's likely to be important, particularly if these are dads who, like Nick, really want to be there for their children. We also ask them about more general things like who does what in the home. And prenatally, what we find is that if they plan to share things pretty much 50-50, they are more likely to be satisfied with themselves as a couple and their relationship. So divvying things up and giving men the marigolds seem to be a good thing for family life. Having said that, they did in general predict that the mum would be doing more. And when you ask them postnatally, it turns out the mum's doing a lot more. Postnatal visits also showed that satisfaction with how much work each of them is doing is roughly equal in mums and dads. So it's not as a group the mums are happy and the dads are not, or the other way around. But interestingly, completely unrelated within couples. So if mum is happy doesn't mean that dad is, and vice versa. So it sounds like this is something that they need to be talking to each other about, particularly because how they're satisfied with the division of work seems to be related to couple satisfaction and to distress or depression. And forewarned does not seem to be forearmed in this situation. So mums who knew when they were pregnant that they were likely to be doing more of the work than they had would like to have in the kind of ideal world, they are just as dissatisfied four months in. So it doesn't help that you know that things are going to be unequal. You kind of really need to do something about it, is kind of the impression that I've been getting. So from the questionnaires, what we've picked up is a high levels of prenatal anxiety, I think perhaps more so than in a time before the internet. That's certainly something that the parents talk to us a lot about in those prenatal interviews, is looking things up. And then this unexpected contrast in the impact of parenthood on mothers and fathers, and that sharing housework seems to make a difference to everything. In the last couple of minutes, I just want to wrap up with, remember I asked you to think about your child and how you'd describe your child. Both prenatally and postnatally, we got the researchers asked the parents to do this. And what we did with that is we coded, some parents find this really easy, some find it really difficult. Most people find it's quite difficult. You dry up quite easily when you're asked, put on the spot like that to talk about your child. We're not interested in how much they talk, we're interested in what kinds of things they're saying. And so we divided it into whether they were giving mental attributes or behavioural or physical. So you could be really positive and say, I hope she has her dad's lovely blue eyes, for example. That's a nice thing to say about your unborn child, but it's not really thinking about them as a person. And you could have, or you could equally anticipate, so these are prenatal examples and these are postnatal examples. And so it was kind of interesting that what we found, well, from that literature, we're thinking that that ability to be mind-minded would make a difference. And what we find in this study is that parents show a big increase. They can make mind-minded comments even before they've met their baby. So they can imagine their baby as a child with interests and what they're going to be passionate about and what they'll like and not like. But then it's obviously much easier to do it once you actually have a baby there in front of you. And again, the mums are showing a greater increase over time than the dads. And I think that's just to do with the fact that the mums in this sample are spending much more time with their baby. So what predicts this variation? Interestingly, you get a sortative mating in mind-mindedness as much as you do for other characteristics. Presumably the way one person talks about their child will influence how the other person thinks or talks about their child. It goes up with education, that would be kind of what you'd expect. And interestingly for the dads, the depressed dads were more mind-minded. And I think what that is coming from is that actually one of the other predictors, it's not on there, is that infant characteristics. If you had an infant who's quite difficult, who cries a lot, you might be thinking more about what does this child need, what does this child want. So that, but that also might be helping you to feel a bit more depressed because your life is harder because you've got this difficult baby. So it's all very early days to kind of unpick what the direction of effects is for all of these things. But these are the sorts of things that we'll be looking for. Interestingly, we don't get an association between whether you're mind-minded prenatally or postnatally. I think they're rather different kinds of descriptions that we're getting And it may be that they both matter. We don't yet know. Like the my-mindedness, the theory of mind, we've also shown that Asian parents, parents in Hong Kong, are less likely to be my-minded about their children than parents in the UK. And that explains the part of the difference in the children. So the kind of take-home message overall is when thinking about children, don't forget fathers or the couple relationship or non-parental issues. It's really a very kind of complex picture. Thinking about family life as being like a river, so it keeps on changing, and as the family grows in size, the nature of that river will change as well. Clearly room for some prenatal education about what's coming to you as a parent, for parents like June, for example, who had no idea. And then really making sure that there's mental health support for parents and that it's there for dads as well as for mums. And on that note, I'll stop.